20. So here we go with 1 Samuel chapters 20 and 21. David fled from Naioth in Ramah. He came before Jonathan and said, "What have I done? What is my guilt? And what is my sin against your father, that he is trying to take my life?" He said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. My father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? Never." But David also swore, "Your father knows well that you like me, and he thinks, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." David said to Jonathan, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at the meal. But let me go, so that I may hide in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family.' If he says, 'Good,' it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that evil has been determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a sacred covenant with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself. Why should you bring me to your father?" Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. If I knew that it was decided by my father that evil should come upon you, would I not tell you?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" Jonathan replied to David, "Come, let us go out into the field." So they both went out into the field. Jonathan said to David, "By the Lord, the God of Israel, when I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow, or on the third day, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But if my father intends to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you, and send you away so that you may go in safety. May the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, show me the faithful love of the Lord. But if I die, never cut off your faithful love from my house, even if the Lord were to cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." Thus Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord seek out the enemies of David." Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own life. Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon. You will be missed because your place will be empty. On the day after tomorrow, you shall go a long way down. Go to the place where you hid yourself earlier and remain beside the stone there. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a mark. Then I will send the boy, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, collect them,' then you are to come, for as the Lord lives, it is safe for you and there is no danger. But if I say to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then go, for the Lord has sent you away. As for the matter about which you and I have spoken, the Lord is witness between you and me forever." So David hid himself in the field. When the new moon came, the king sat at the feast to eat. The king sat upon his seat, as at other times, upon the seat by the wall. Jonathan stood, while Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, "Something has befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean." But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to the feast, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go, for our family is holding a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your sight, let me get away and see my brothers.' For this reason, he has not come to the king's table." Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Now send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered his father Saul, Why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul threw his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that it was the decision of his father to put David to death. Duh. Jonathan, that wasn't in scripture. Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food on the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David and because his father had disgraced him. In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David, and with him was a little boy. He said to the boy, Run and find the arrows that I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called after the boy and said, Is not the arrow beyond you? Jonathan called after the boy, Hurry, be quick, do not linger. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the arrangement. Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said to him, Go and carry them to the city. As soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept with each other. David wept the more. Then Jonathan said to David, Go in peace, since both of us have sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever. He got up and left, and Jonathan went into the city. David came to Nob, to the priest Ahimelech. Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, Why are you alone and no one with you? David said to the priest Ahimelech, The king has charged me with the matter and said to me, No one must know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with the young men for such and such a place. Now then, what have you at hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here. The priest answered David, I have no ordinary bread at hand, only holy bread, provided that the young men have kept themselves from women. David answered the priest, Indeed, women have been kept from us, as always, when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is a common journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there except the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. David said to Ahimelech, Is there no spear or sword here with you? I did not bring my sword or my weapons with me because the king's business required haste. The priest said, The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none here except that one. David said, There is none like it. Give it to me. David rose and fled that day from Saul. He went to King Achish of Gath. The servants of Achish said to him, Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing to one another of him in dances, Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000s? David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of King Achish of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them. He pretended to be mad when in their presence. He scratched marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, Look, you see the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
All right. So David comes before Jonathan and he says, Why is it that Saul kills me? I just don't quite get it. And Jonathan tries to reassure him and says, Don't worry. He's not going to kill you. He talks to me about everything, absolutely everything. So if he does get it in his head to do you some harm, I'll know about it and I'll let you know and you can hide. But David's like, well, you know, he knows that you and I are really best friends. We're BFFs. And so this might be something he does hide from you so he doesn't upset you and so that you don't tell me. And it's kind of dramatic, you know. As the Lord lives and you yourself live, there is but a step between me and death. And he says, look, David, I'm going to do whatever I can for you, whatever you ask. And David says, well, you know, tomorrow's the New Moon Festival. And this was like the first of the month in the Jewish calendar, and it appears that it required a festival, apparently 3 days of duration, in which you would rest. So it was sort of like an extended Sabbath. You would feast and you would make sacrifices. And you can read about that in Numbers chapter 28, verses 11 through 15. And there are a few other citations that I put in your notes. And, you know, being absent from this type of meal would be significant and certainly would have raised Saul's suspicions. And so they come up with this elaborate plan. David's going to hide in the field. And if Saul notices that David is gone and starts asking questions, Jonathan's story is, you know, David needed to go back home to Bethlehem because they're having this annual special sacrifice for his family, and his brothers really don't want him to miss it. And if Saul's like, well, that's good, I'm glad he could do that, then we're okay. But if he's upset, then we know that he's still after me. And then he starts begging Jonathan, you know, please be faithful to me. Please be faithful to our covenant. You know, if I've done something wrong, I would just rather you kill me. You know, better a friend than an enemy to put me down. And Jonathan is kind of like, get a hold of yourself. If Dad's after you, I'm going to let you know. And then David's like, well, how will I know? I mean, and so he said, well, let's go out into the field. And so here's how we're going to do this. And it's kind of funny. If Dad's going to hurt you, I'm going to come out here with a boy and I'm going to do some archery practice. And I'm going to send the boy out for the arrows. It's nice to have somebody to do that for you. And depending on the instructions I give him as to where the arrows are, you know, why are you looking over there? I think it's over there. Why are you looking over there? I think it's over there. Then, you know, depending on what directions I give him, you'll find out whether Dad's still wanting to kill you or not. Which is kind of ridiculous because in the end they end up talking face to face. So what is that all about? And he makes this solemn vow that in the name of Yahweh, that he will be faithful to the love. We remember we talked about the love that the people had for David, and that his wife Michal had for David, and that Jonathan had for David. This immense love, which is more than affection, but it's a sense of loyalty and obligation to a person. So they sort of exchange these solemn vows, and he says, you know, maybe we're going to meet in a day, maybe it'll be 3 days, we'll sort of see how it goes. And the first day of the New Moon Festival, Saul's there and David's gone, and he thinks, well, you know, he's probably ritually impure. There was tons of stuff that you could do to make yourself ritually impure. There's a very long list in Leviticus chapters 11 through 15. Save it for bedtime. You'll sleep well. Saul's kind of like, well, you know, he's probably, you know, having to, you know, do some ritual to work off some defilement. He'll be here tomorrow night. Next night doesn't show up. Saul says to his son Jonathan, where is he? And it's interesting because he refuses to call him by name. He calls him the son of Jesse throughout. So he's so furious with David that he cannot even utter his name. And so Jonathan tells him this story. Well, you know, David said, I really need to go to Bethlehem. Is that okay with you? Can I have a few days off? It's a big family shindig. And I said, sure, that's all right. And Saul is like, that's not your place. You know, nobody is a no-show at the royal court, especially for a festival, without my say-so. You don't have that authority. So he gets angry with Jonathan. He insults him. He curses him. He insults his mother. You know, and, you know, so, you know, he's getting into the yo mama territory. So we know how tight Saul's getting. And this business about to the shame of your mother's nakedness, Nakedness is sometimes used in the Old Testament as a euphemism for genitals. And so basically, he's saying, you've betrayed the mother who gave you birth. You know, and so it's that's pretty severe. And he says, aren't you aware that as long as the son of Jesse's alive, that, you know, you're not going to become king? And Jonathan's like, he doesn't say so, but he's thinking, yeah, I know, and I'm totally okay with that. Because it's pretty clear to me that to Yahweh, bloodlines don't matter. He's going to choose the king he wants, and he's chosen David. So Saul says, bring him here so I can kill him. And Jonathan starts taking up for David. And he's like, well, what has he done to deserve that? And so then Saul picks up his spear again. He's really into spear throwing, although obviously he's not very good at it. I mean, you're in a room probably about this size, and you can't pin anybody against the wall. So he throws it at Jonathan, and he's like, well, if he's mad enough to throw the spear at me, God knows what he's going to do to David. So he gets angry, runs. He can't eat. He's so upset. And because the nasty things his dad said about him in front of everybody else. So he goes out into the field, does the thing with the arrows, sends the boy away, and then they actually have a nice face-to-face. And, you know, Jonathan delivers the news and sort of establishes this covenant where basically he's asking for mercy for his descendants. Because obviously when David ascends to the throne, one of the things that he's going to need to do is eliminate any, you know, potential threat, which would be Saul and his entire family. Now, Jonathan dies at the end of 1 Samuel in battle, but then the question is what happens to everybody else? And this is a foreshadowing of something we'll read about in a few months in 2 Samuel chapter 9, where David does keep that promise for the remnant of Jonathan's family. So David runs away and he goes to Nob. And he goes to the priest Ahimelech. And Ahimelech's a little suspicious. He's a little nervous. I mean, one, you have a military leader. He's traveling alone, which is strange. And, you know, this guy's an important person. So he probably has a pretty good idea of what's happening at the royal court. And that Saul's not too happy with David. And so David lies to him. Yes, Saul sent me here on a covert op. I can't really tell you about it or I have to kill you. I've set up to meet with some guys here who are going to help me. We need some food. What you got? 5 loaves of bread ought to do it. And he says, you know, I'm all out. The only thing I have is the bread that we put in the tabernacle, the bread of the presence. And but I guess I can give you that. As long as, you know, the guys you're going to share it with have remained pure. And what he's talking about here is, you know, sex. Why sex was considered impure remains a mystery to me. But before you went into battle, and this is, you can go back to Joshua chapter 3 and read about this. Before you'd go into battle, you had to restrain from sexual relations for a period of time so that you could be pure when you went into battle, so that Yahweh would be with you and you could be victorious. And so David says, oh, no. We've been abstaining, just like we always do. And so the priest gives it to him. And this is astonishing, because Leviticus chapter 24, verses 8 through 9, commands that only the priests can eat the old bread. Because what they do is they put fresh bread, 12 loaves in there, on the Sabbath every week. And then when they had the freshly baked bread, they'd replace the bread that was over there. And you had to do something with it. So the priests had to eat this stale, moldy bread. And if you look in the Gospels, you know, Jesus is continually confronted by the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who are saying, you or your disciples are violating the law of Moses, trying to undermine Jesus' authority. And so in all three of the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I've given you the citations in your notes, but for the benefit of the four people listening online, one of the citations is Mark chapter 2, verses 25 through 26. He says, well, you know, when David was on the run, Ahimelech gave him the loaves that only a priest could eat. So, you know, there are exceptions. There are exceptions to the rules in the right circumstances. But, you know, implicitly, Jesus was saying, you know, what David did, what Ahimelech did was wrong. So this is a significant sign, because in what we did last week in chapters 18 and 19, you know, David goes running to Samuel. And Samuel's already anointed him privately. And so you sort of have the chief prophet protecting him. And so that's one big power base in Israel that's staunchly behind him. Now you see the priesthood lining up behind him and helping him. Because Ahimelech was the great-grandson of Eli. And yes, Eli and his family was disgraced because Eli's sons were wicked and greedy and blasphemous, and God cursed them. But, you know, at this point, he still has some pull, you know, and despite what had happened. So you see the priesthood kind of lining up behind David. The people are already on their side, because they're singing about, well, Saul slayed his thousands and David 10 times as many. So so you see increasingly that, you know, this consensus is forming around all the major power bases that David is far and away superior to Saul. Of course, there was Doeg the Edomite, and I just think that's a wonderful name, Doeg, or Doeg. I mean, what a great name for a snitch, don't you think? And he's listening to all this, and he's going to tell Saul, and awful things are going to happen in chapters 22 and 23. And, you know, after David gets the bread he wants, he says, you know, I had to leave quick, and I didn't have time to grab any weapons. You got anything around I could borrow? And he says, well, you know, there is the sword of Goliath here, if you'd like that. And in some translations, it says spear. It just depends, again, on which source you go with. So, you know, if you think this will do, and then David's like, oh yeah, that'll do. That's a pretty good sword. I should know. And so he runs, and he goes to Gath, which is really weird, because that's Goliath's hometown. And the king there, the people are saying, hey, this is David. And I think David's plan was, okay, I'm going to go to the land of the Philistines where nobody knows me. And I'm just kind of going to blend in. I'm going to lay low. And that way Saul will have no clue where to find me. Because there's always a tattletale, it seems like, wherever I go, and he chases me down. But, you know, here's the problem. They know who he is. And there are some significant risks to that. He has continually led armies and beaten the Philistines. So their desire for vengeance was probably very great. They could have held him for ransom, a ransom that would have never come from Saul, or they could have just killed him. And so he's like, oh boy, how am I going to get out of this one? So he puts on this, I think, at least Oscar nominee performance, if not Oscar winning performance. He as a crazy guy, you know, and he's scratching the doors of the gates and he's frothing at the mouth. And I love this, where the king says, this guy's nuts. I've got plenty of crazy people around me already. Get rid of him, you know. And then, as it says in the first verse of chapter 22, David left there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So that's 21 and 22. And, you know, we see David taking a more active role here. You know, I mentioned last week that, you know, up until this point, David's been sort of a passive participant in the story. You know, his wife, his friend Jonathan, have been interceding on his behalf. And of course, Yahweh is behind all of it, including Saul's wrath. But here David is starting to take a more active role in aligning forces behind him that will eventually enable him to seize the throne when the right moment, the Kairos moment of God, appears. But even David's initiative has been born of Yahweh's initiative. The principal, if not sole, role of Yahweh in the execution of all these things is continually emphasized in the text, because only he can choose a king. It's very clear from the very beginning. But already with king number one, you see a corruption of the way God intends the monarchy to run. Because Saul definitely has it in his mind that his son Jonathan will succeed him to the throne. So what am I missing? What questions do you have that I can deflect to another person because I don't know the answer to it? Oh, bizarre, yeah.
And why would he do that?
Well, it's the love that he had for David. You know, there was just something special about him. He was a gifted musician. He was incredibly brave as a young man, basically nothing more than a boy, to go out to fight this towering giant. He was smart enough to realize that he couldn't fight Goliath on his own terms. He had to use what little he had to win the victory. So he had rescued Israel. He was put in command over part of the army and, you know, continually beat the Philistines back. There was just something about him that was so awe-inspiring. And I think for some people, I mean, certainly Jonathan identified it as the Spirit of Yahweh being upon him. And so Jonathan was sufficiently awe-stricken, and I think also sufficiently faithful to the covenant with God, that he realized that the throne wasn't rightfully his, and that David was the type of person that God would choose, or maybe even had chosen. Because remember, the anointing by Samuel was a secret. Just like it was initially with Saul. But it was an immense sacrifice. And so the intensity of more than a friendship between these two men what a treasure. You know, what a treasure to have someone that you have such a strong connection with that you're willing to sacrifice your kingdom, your birthright, you know, and to defend him against your homicidal father, and even when dad starts throwing spears in your general direction, you stay faithful to David. I mean, Jonathan is willing to do anything for him, anything at all, and he asks for basically nothing. The only thing that he asks for in any of this is David's continued covenant faithfulness with him, his ongoing love, but the only specific tangible request he makes is that be kind to my descendants.
Well, that's the important thing in the Jewish heritage,
your progeny. Oh, absolutely. Well, it's true for any, I think. I mean, I was certainly delighted when I had a boy, you know, because I'm the only son of an only son. And so, you know, if I'd not had a boy, and of course I was equally glad to have Emma. But when I really was. And, she had me wrapped around her finger in about, I don't know, 3 seconds after she came into this world. So for our line of the Delk family to continue, I had to have a male child. We had to have a male child and hope that someday he would have a male child. Because I'm the only son of an only son.
Same thing happens in our family. Jacob's the last of the line. Yeah. Our grandson's the last of our line.
And in a tribal society like Israel, the importance of that would be immensely magnified because of how complicated the inheritance would be if all you had were female heirs. It's really not that much different than Henry VIII. You know, he didn't go from wife to wife because he was lustful, although he was. But his principal motive was, you know, none of these women were bearing him surviving male heirs. And he realized how destabilizing that could be for his kingdom. And their belief back then, they didn't understand about XY chromosomes and everything, of course. And so their belief was is that if a woman came from a family that predominantly had boys, that it was a pretty good bet that she would bear boys for you. You know, Henry not realizing that this was basically all his fault. So that's why he went from wife to wife to wife to wife trying to get a male heir, because of the inheritance. And the same would have applied, you know, in ancient times with Israel.
The irony in Henry's case was that his daughters both turned out to be queen. Yeah. One of them turned out to be the great queen.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, God works in mysterious ways, and
they've changed it in England now that it's the firstborn that inherits, whether it's
really. Oh, I didn't know that. I'll be. It's the firstborn.
Huh.
Well, and as it should be, as it should be. Lord knows Elizabeth II's done a very fine job. So.
Did Saul miss spear throwing camp when he was a boy?
Yeah, it's one of the things I love about this story is, you know, there are these comical moments, and you know, Saul is just really bad at spear throwing, and I sort of see this banqueting hall. And, you know, Saul just, you know, goes all Rambo, and people are like doing duck and cover. And, you know, and I see David and then Jonathan just kind of, you know, running around the room. It's almost like they're playing dodgeball, except if you get hit, you die. And you know, and Saul's, you know, and just like wham against Saul. Ah! You know, and yeah, I think maybe this sort of comic relief is also devoted to the same purpose, that Saul is a seriously flawed person, you know, and his competency is so deficient, you know, because all through this they're making the case for David, you know. David was the best king Israel ever had, but in these ancient works of early prophecy and history, you're trying to explain why was David so great. And so in comparison to Saul, I mean, Mr. Magoo would have been great, but and you have to be impressed that at my age I know who Mr. Magoo is. And then of course David in his own right, but yeah, they're building him up. Humble shepherd boy, you know, musician brought in by the king, kills Goliath, wins the favor of the king's sons and daughters, who basically betray their father in favor of David. He continually escapes Saul's attempts to kill him, not just, you know, the spear throwing, but, you know, all these other machinations that Saul's doing. He's continually victorious in military conflicts. And then you have Saul, who, you know, would be better off blindfolded when he starts chucking spears around the room. And, you know, he's afflicted by an evil spirit. He's not in his right mind. And he's paranoid, although I guess since what he's worried about is actually real, I guess you can't say that he's paranoid. But
I see him as being overly controlled by his emotions, so that reasonable actions, such as connecting his spear to his target. It's not possible.
Well,
he's just so controlled by his own anger that he just flings it.
And he's kind of a pitiful figure, too. And there's really nothing sadder than a pitiful leader. And of course, a lot of this goes back to the fact that, you know, they had this battle against the Philistines. Saul's troops plundered, they were hungry. So they started sacrificing animals in an improper way. And Saul's the king, he's the leader of the army, and the captain's responsible for everything that happens on the ship. You know, so that was, you know, kind of the beginning of the end for Saul. You know, it seems like a little thing that should be of, you know, not great significance, but, you know, these cultic obligations were important. And then he tried to remedy the situation by, you know, creating a sort of ersatz altar that he could, you know, sacrifice on properly, but that's not his job. And Samuel comes and gives him both barrels for doing that. You know, so it's like he does not understand what it means to be king. He just doesn't get it. Caroline?
I was going to say that there's been a lot of conjecture about what this love that Jonathan had for David was. And so I guess we probably shouldn't just gloss over the fact that a lot of people think that this was a homosexual love.
Yes.
So, yeah. Say something about that.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they talk about this love and they infer that, you know, Jonathan and David had a sexual relationship. When you look at the verbs and the nouns that we translate from Hebrew into English as love, there is no sexual connotation whatsoever in those words. It has to do with loyalty, admiration, a covenantal faithfulness. It's basically the same words that are used in reference to the relationship between Israel and God. Okay? And because in this era, and particularly when you look at what books like Leviticus have to say about homosexual intercourse, it would have been unimaginable for these two men to have had a sexual relationship. So I think that that's an inference that reads way too much into the text. It has absolutely no support from textual criticism. And what textual criticism is you're actually analyzing words and you're like, okay, how is this used in other contexts in Scripture? In other words, on the whole, you know, what's the majority report on how these words are used? And these particular words, uniformly throughout the Old Testament, are used in no way to connote sexual affection. So this is just this kind of, I'm trying to think of a contemporary analog. And I'm just, you know, particularly for people in high leadership positions, I mean, maybe the relationship between JFK and RFK, maybe. That's a potential analog. I mean, they were actually blood brothers, whereas David and Jonathan were not, and of course it was a very different situation there, but you know, and maybe the fact that I'm having difficulty coming up with a contemporary analog is that these types of relationships are truly very, very rare. I mean, Jonathan was willing to sacrifice everything, apparently even his life and his relationship with his father, and David's sister, Jonathan's sister, the same way, in order to facilitate David's safety, and more than just his safety. I mean, they were trying to keep him safe for a reason, because they saw something in him that Saul also saw, but they saw the hand of Yahweh at work in that. whereas Saul was completely blind to it. And it was his inability to see God at work in the scenario that exposes more than anything else how unfit Saul was to lead the covenant people.
My question is, both that Michael and Jonathan's devotion to David really stems from their devotion to God?
Well, no, I think so. Which is another contrast between them and Saul. I mean, it's very evident, especially in the types of oaths that Jonathan and David offer to one another, that they see Yahweh right in the middle of all this. And so Saul's kids see something that he can't, you know.
My question is, once appointed a king, mm-hmm. are you always a king, kind of like the Supreme Court? Once you are picked,
Charles the First of Pope.
But I mean, is that the way it has always been? That the only way he's no longer a king is if he passes away.
Yeah, I'm unaware of any monarchy where there were term limits. I mean, you could definitely, I suppose, recuse yourself in favor of
someone else,
of an elder son. But yeah, generally there was two ways to stop being king. You died. Three ways. Sorry, you died gloriously in battle. You died at a ripe old age, in your bed, or you were assassinated. That's how these types of transitions were made in the ancient world. So, I mean, in a way, it's very much like the papacy. I mean, what Benedict did in sort of, I guess resigning is not the right word, but he had come to a point where he felt his health was insufficient to support the incredible demands of being Pope. And so he convened the College of Cardinals to find a successor for him. And I really admire the fact that he has really just hunkered down and stayed out of everything. But that was the first Pope in 400 years who did that voluntarily. And so, yeah, I mean, that's killed in battle, assassinated, or defer to a blood relative. But that did not happen very often.
So he must have been putting on a show for all the people then, because obviously he seems very troubled with everything that's going on with David and Jonathan and all of that.
Yeah.
Because he must be able to cover that up from all the people he's sovereign over.
Well, it's hard to say whether, you know, the people at large were aware of Saul's instability. Certainly his court would have been aware of it. And, you know, presumably rumors spread. And how he was in public, maybe he could, you know, put on a face and, you know, when he was out and about, beyond his, you know, most trusted counselors. But I'm pretty sure people knew. And that may be why they had such tremendous love for David, same verb and noun as between Jonathan and David, from the people, and why they praised him so highly. Judy.
And the Philistines say, "Is this not David the king of the land?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when your enemies are identifying you as king, I mean, it's obvious that they're either confused or they no longer see Saul as a legitimate king. You know, David's the actual ruler. Saul's just king by title, by name. But this is actually their boss. So
he's actually just lost control, period.
Yeah. I mean, you can't help but feel a little sorry for Saul. I mean, he's seeing the shadow falling, and he can't get out from underneath it, no matter what he does. And the shadow is one of his own making, and he doesn't realize it. I mean, he's just... It's the bullies. It's the really vicious and vengeful people in the world that I think are most deserving of our pity because of their invincible ignorance, their arrogance, their total lack of comprehension. They're so self-absorbed and fearful that they miss it. I mean, they're just in a different reality, you know. I mean, when you consider how renowned David was among the people and among the principal power bases, Saul would have been an idiot to kill him. You know, if anything, he should have, you know, roped himself to David. You know, get a little bit of the glow from David, you know, so you can preserve some measure of legitimacy. I mean, why are you interested in Jonathan, you know, succeeding you anymore? He's already betrayed you in favor of this guy. But Saul just can't see it. He can't see Yahweh's hand at work. He's trying to force the situation, you know, and had he succeeded in killing David, with the great acclaim that David had, I mean, how do you think people were going to react to Saul on that one? So the guy's just blind, not just when he's throwing spears, but he is totally blind to the reality.
How much time I know we don't know exactly, but about has gone on since, say, the battle with Goliath, and where we finished today?
We have no idea. Yeah, we don't even know how long Saul reigned. There are lacunae in the texts and some contradictory evidence about the timeline, and so there's no way to know. Yeah. I mean, the events that are described, presuming that they are a consistent and comprehensive chronicle, you know, all of these things could have happened in the course of a couple of years, maybe even less. It would all depend on the pace of armed conflict. You know, did the Philistines and Israel go at it on a really regular basis? Or was this kind of an on-again, off-again thing where, you know, they go to war and, you know, they, you know, have a settlement, you know, and then a little time goes by and, you know, you do it again. That's right. Let's do it again.
It intrigues me because when Saul becomes king, he doesn't have a lot of wealth or anything.
Yeah.
So there had to be a fair time to go for him to have a court and all the trappings of it.
Yeah.
From the time he was, I mean, okay, we're going to start taxing you now, as God said I would.
Yep.
But it still takes a little time to amass and control the whole thing, I would think.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it would take more than a few years. I mean, yeah. We know that it was more than 2 years, because the text actually, it's like dot, 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 and 2 years. And so we know it was at least a couple of years and definitely more, or you wouldn't have, you know, this lacunae connected with the "and 2 years." But, you know, I could see him hoovering up resources pretty quickly. You know, it doesn't take too terribly long to put a system in place in a fairly discrete geographical area and start levying these tithe taxes and requisitioning materials and people, you know. So I'm not sure that it would have taken him very much time, Peter, because, you know, the people wanted a king. The consequences of that were explained to them in detail by God through Samuel. They wanted a king anyway. And so you would assume that maybe it would take him longer if he was facing resistance. But I think it's entirely plausible that they were happy to cooperate with him. You know, yeah, he's a king. He should, you know, have gold-plated toilets and the whole nine yards, you know. So let's, you know, suck it up and load up a caravan and send it to him in Gibeah. So.
Is there anything symbolic, or is it just a bad story, the whole thing about the shooting of the arrows? Something more to it? We just...
You know, not that I can see, and not that I've read in either of the commentaries I'm using to prepare for our time together. It's obviously a blending of tradition. You know, there are these kind of little hitches in the narrative where you're kind of like, uh-huh, you know. And whenever you get that, generally it's, you know, there are two primary layers going on here that have been sort of sewn together as best as possible. And even then, because of the condition of the oldest texts that we have and the fact that they disagree with each other and all that, it's, you know, you have this thing where it's like, okay, so you're going to hide behind this rock. And, you know, just to keep you safe, I'm going to shoot some arrows. And I'm going to send the boy out to fetch the arrows. And you know, I'm going to say, you're looking in the wrong place. And depending on whether I say, try looking over there or try looking over there, this is your yes, this is your no. This is your safe, this is your danger, you know. And then he sends the boy out and it's like, okay, here's what happened. And you're kind of like, all right, well, so what was the point of that? So I don't think there is any real symbolism in that. It's
just one of those odd things.
Yeah, and, you know, it charges the narrative with a measure of suspense and, you know, conspiracy. And obviously,
and truthfulness.
Yeah, and the people who sew this together, I mean, if they didn't think that it was historically accurate, they weren't going to keep it, you know. And so maybe this is exactly how it went down. And both narratives are correct in that he did shoot the arrow, and that was the original plan. But then they decided to have a face-to-face anyway. I mean, who knows? But that's a good question, Dave, because I honestly hadn't thought about whether there was any significance in, I guess, you know, based on the study that I've done, it's not even been something that's been addressed, so I would guess not.
I would say initially it was to keep David's location secret.
Yeah.
Sure. Initially. So perhaps after the boy was sent away is when they
were yeah. Face. And maybe it was a conditional thing where, you know, if you got somebody like Doeg, you know, lurking about, and you can't, you know, talk face to face, but, you know, it's like, okay, nobody's within eye, I can't see anybody around, nobody's within earshot, you know, we can have a quick talk, you know, and of course, certainly, if, you know, Saul has decided that David's okay for now. But yeah, it's interesting. Caroline?
I was interested in this performance that he put on, again, when he went through the gap. Is this something that he is obviously must have been very good at?
Yeah, he's... David's a good liar.
Was he a tricky person?
Well, I mean, look at Bathsheba Gate. His residence, the palace, you know, he's got a good view of all Jerusalem, and he sees this woman taking a bath on her rooftop, and, you know, he just can't get her out of his mind, and he sends her flowers and chocolate, and she writes him back, I'm a married woman, and so he says, well, I can fix that. He summons his general staff, and he says, so we're going to go to battle. And what you're going to do is you're going to let this guy go out all by himself, and then you're going to retreat and so he can get slaughtered. Trust me, it's for a good reason. And then I'll be able to offer consolation to the bereaved widow. And so, yeah, I mean, the guy was a masterful liar. He fooled Ahimelech, you know, who was, you know, a priest, had probably seen it all and wasn't an idiot. He managed to fool the Philistines of Gath and continually elude Saul's efforts. I mean, you know, to, I mean, you know, I mean, to get out from underneath a, basically a death penalty from a king, that's no small feat.
No.
You know.
I like that the stone that he hides behind has a name. I mean, you know, it's incredible. Stone in the...
And where are you?
He's in the stone, where he's in the
19,
field,
yeah,
with 20. The arrows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The stone has it. I mean, oh, yeah, it does.
Well, and big stones were important markers, and oftentimes were used as sort of temporary shrines or altars. I mean, you see this throughout, right at the beginning of the entry into the Promised Land, and early on in Joshua, where they go across the Jordan on dry land because they're, you know, holding the Ark of the Covenant in the middle of the riverbank. To mark that occasion, they set up a cairn of stones, you know, and, you know, what would hopefully be a permanent marker of this miraculous event in the life of the people. And so big rocks could be a big deal. You know, Jacob did the same thing when he wrestled with the angel at the banks of the Jabbok River. He decides to erect a, you know, a pillar of stones. So, yeah. Because, I mean, when you think about it, there's a permanence there, mm-hmm. You know, trees die or get cut down, you know, rivers dry up, but big boulders generally tend to stay where they are. And so they're good markers. It's just about 11, so we have time for a couple of more contributions. If you've got anything, anybody who hasn't had a chance to talk that has an insight, don't be bashful.
Surprised they didn't give a translation of what the word Ezel meant, because often they do that in the Bible.
Yeah, I'll try to see if I can find that somewhere.
David,
this one is known as the spot that we had on the other occasion.
This is the meaning is uncertain.
Yeah, I'm not sure I even have that in the RSV.
We did on the other occasion. Wait, here's the one thing. The name of the stone.
That Moses is not.
So, next week then, we will tackle chapters 22 and 23. In a lot of ways, more of the same, but it's still fun. I've got to remember, I've got a map, a good map, in one of my commentaries that actually diagrams
where David's
going. Everywhere David goes. And I was sitting there last night looking at this map, sort of like, okay, because, I mean, he moves around so much, it's going, okay, see, this oak, and then this arrow goes here. And they actually had it numbered. There were so many way stations along the way, they had to have it numbered. So, well, let's say a prayer together.